You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, May 23rd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Turns out, ladies and gentlemen, Hapsher didn't show up. So I want you to know we are extending the offer of 220% refund on your membership just in the event that maybe somebody added wrong, maybe there was some wrong addition, subtraction, multiplication, I'm not exactly sure. On the program today, Eli Pariser, former executive director of MoveOn.org, president of MoveOn's board, on his new book, The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, all the news you can use. But first, let's go for an update on the Republican clown car race. Oh, my computer's not working. You're not getting sound from my computer. Evan's not with us today. There we go. All right. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, turns out Governor Mitch Daniels is dropping out of the race. Well, I guess he's never entered the race. I think he realized he had no chance of winning. And Tim Pawlenty in the race. What, this is like the fourth time he's announced now? I have to say, I listened to his announcement video. It was the longest 2.5 minutes I've ever experienced in my entire life. I don't even know what to tell you. I was going to play it, but that would stretch the time-space continuum. So, one less Republican that is going to be joining us in the race. Mitch Daniels, what are you going to do? Here's an update on one of those. This is quite fun.
Hockey moms of the world, unite! History will be made tonight. And her name is Sarah Palin.
That's John Huntsman at the Republican National Convention back in 08. Listen to this.
Sarah. We're here.
We're here
as a party, united and excited for a McCain Palin presidency.
Oh, that video's on YouTube. So, sorry.
Hey, what happened?
There's John Huntsman with laryngitis. I can imagine now he can only wish that he had absolutely no voice. So that's the present state of the clown car race, the one that enables Democrats from doing their jobs and protecting working class people, the vast majority of Americans. at a time when unemployment is unacceptably high and, of course, unemployment insurance running out for people across the country. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Eli Pariser, author of The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. Put it down. Evan's absent today, folks. We'll be right back after this. On the phone, I'd like to welcome back to the program Eli Pariser, author of The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. And, of course, he's the former executive director of Move On, now president of Move On's board. Eli, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's get into this. Your book, The Filter Bubble, lays out a case that one could say it's one of the benefits of the web is in some ways not fulfilling its promise.
That's right. Yeah. We all thought that the web was going to be this amazing connective thing that introduced us to new ideas and new kinds of people. And what is increasingly looking like is that the web is actually, very good at introducing us to people like us and ideas like us and things we might like, and not very good at getting us outside of that little, local narrow terrain. And the way that this is happening is this kind of invisible shift in how websites serve pages. It used to be the case that, most of the time, if you went to a page and I went to a page, we'd see the same page. And now because these websites have so much information about each visitor, they can actually personally tailor the results that you see. So, for example, Google actually gives different search results to different people based on the information that's gathered about them.
So in other words, if you and I were both to go to Google right now and Google garden weeds or something, we'd actually get different type of info, or is it?
Yeah, and in that case, the reason that Google is doing this it's not some conspiracy. They're trying to give people the results that they'll click the most. And so, with garden weeds, I would get a different thing based on where I am in the country than you might where you are based in the country. That's all fine when it's garden weeds, but it's a problem when it's climate change or Obama or birth certificate or whatever. You actually start to have, without really knowing it, your own views fed back to you.
Fascinating. And so now, let's back up for a minute. How did you come to decide to write this book?
Well, it actually started on Facebook, and I am a progressive, proudly, but I've
You're
always
kidding.
Gone out of the way to, I know it may shock some listeners. I've always gone out of my way to meet people who think differently from me. I like hearing, what conservatives are talking about and thinking about. I had gone on this sort of little mini campaign to befriend people on Facebook who would be feeding me information that was gonna be, more right-leaning, just to find out what they were talking about. And I woke up one morning and I noticed that it had disappeared. Like it wasn't on my Facebook feed. And what Facebook was actually doing was it was saying, yes, yes, you think you want to hear from these people, but actually we're watching every click and every like and every engagement that you make on the site. And we know that while you say you want to hear from conservatives, actually you're clicking more on the liberal links, you're engaging more with those people, so we're going to show you that. And so, you know, without asking me about it, it sort of invisibly edited my, you know, my sense of what my friends were talking about. And that really got me thinking, and I started doing some research, and as it turns out, this is happening almost on every major website on the internet. I mean, for a simple reason, which is that you can make more money if you show people stuff that they're likely to like. And that's all fine to a certain extent, but the problem is that there are lots of really important things that people, you know, that people need to hear about that will never be the first thing that they click. You know, in other words, you know, we're all more tuned to click on cat videos and celebrity gossip and whatever than to click on, you know, the latest heartbreaking, complicated story from Afghanistan. And so that drops out, and you're left with just the kind of the clicky stuff that doesn't necessarily serve you well.
It's interesting that that Facebook algorithm actually ignores the fact that you've made an active choice to have these people in your feed, and even and despite the fact that you don't necessarily pursue everything that they offer, that they that Facebook's algorithm has made even that assertive of a choice to say, well, you're not clicking through at a rate that really justifies your wanting them here.
Well, here's another really interesting example along the same lines. So Netflix, for you know, does this kind of sort of curation and recommendation, you know, a lot and pretty well. They're on average, they can guess how well you'll like a movie within about a half a star. And recently, though, since this streaming service has taken off and people are watching Netflix on their computers, they've noticed that even those ratings are off. In other words, people will say, we'll give 5 stars to Schindler's List or to Citizen Kane because they feel like they should. But actually, when you watch the streaming behavior, people are watching like 5 minutes of those movies and then clicking over to The Hangover. And so, again, it's this thing of,
that sounds like my weekly movie review guy, actually, who comes in. He has the same problem, frankly.
Well, it's this thing of saying that, you know, we know what you really want, and what you really want is movies like The Hangover. And, you know, my concern is the best media actually gives us a bit of both. I mean, I'm not saying that you don't want movies like The Hangover. I'm saying you want a mix. And if you look at, you know, the best magazines or the best radio shows or whatever, you know, they do balance these two things. You get, you know, some information dessert and some information vegetables, and they're kind of mixed together in a way that leads you along. And what these algorithms do, at least right now, is they often just give you the information, you know, junk food. You don't get, you know, the stuff that you really actually need to hear. And it's not just that, but, you know, some of the most rewarding experiences you have with media, with content, are the things that you kind of slog through the first 100 pages or the first 30 minutes or whatever, and then it changes your life. Right. And that won't be very well represented in these kinds of algorithmic systems that increasingly, you know, are editing the web.
Or it also seems not to allow for any type of happenstance. I mean, you know, for much of my life, most of the time I would listen to college radio and just sort of force myself to keep it on there through a day's worth of programming, because there would be stuff that I would never have imagined would be interesting to me and ultimately ends up being something I'm engaged in.
You get in a kind of loop where, you know, personalized media is showing you the things, the stories, the music, whatever that it thinks you want to see. But the problem with that is that actually, you know, the things we, you know, the media we consume affect who we are and what we're interested in. So, you know, there's sort of this feedback loop where either you can get more and more kind of dug into a few very narrow areas, or you can get exposed to, you know, the whole world. And sometimes that's not going to be as immediately pleasant an experience, but it's the way that you actually hit on those things that are really satisfying.
It's sort of a fairly dramatic problem. I mean, one of the promises of the web was that we would be able to almost program it ourselves, in the sense that, you know, when I grew up, there was three stations plus a couple UHF that I could watch. That was the only sort of media that was coming into the home, short of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. So,
yeah.
And so the promise of the internet was, and maybe even to a lesser extent, cable television, was this idea that if I found an interest that I like, or I would have access, I would be able to sort of seamlessly and without obstacle find stuff and stumble on to stuff. And that is losing to, I guess, the economic incentives of the people who supply that information.
Right. And, you know, the other piece that's different is, I think, you know, we all have this vision of the internet as this thing that connects everyone to everyone, or at least that's how I thought about it. And what that leaves out is that increasingly between everyone and everyone else are a few big companies that are directing that traffic. You know, so it's not, you know, you directly to your local pizza place. It's you to Google to your local pizza place. It's not you to your friend. It's you to Facebook to your friend. And those companies, therefore, have a lot of power to shape what you see and what you don't see, and what choices you feel like you have available to you, and what ideas you come across. And, you know, that's not how this whole thing was originally contemplated. I mean, you know, that's not the sort of democratized media quite that we all had in mind.
So what's the solution to this? I mean, is there a solution? Is there any way to convince, you know, if Netflix or Google knows what I really want, I guess the definition of that is those things that there's a higher yield, I guess, is really the issue. There's a better chance that they'll be able to monetize it in some fashion. Is there any type of solution to this on a grander scale other than to just somewhat ignore what I'm doing or clean my my cookies out, I guess?
Yeah, no, I have a few, you know, sort of basic tips on the website for the book, which is thefilterbubble.com. But I think the bigger question here is, you know, these companies have a choice. And they can either, you know, just focus on the most narrowly clickable stuff, which in the short term at least generates more ad views and more ad revenue. Or they can say, you know what, you know, we have these, you know, $100 billion valuations. We can choose to actually help, you know, build some sense of ethics and civic responsibility into these algorithms that we're making that support the citizen as well as the consumer. And I think that can happen if we, the consumers, actually know about this and say that we want it. I mean, in other words, it's a feature like any other feature that these companies are assessing based on consumer demand. The challenge is nobody knows to demand this yet because most people don't know that it's happening. But that's sort of why I'm writing the book.
Yeah, I'm a little bit cynical about that on some level.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be nice to be able to get maybe just an opt-in. Like, I would like something that is a little more expansive than not. But I guess theoretically at that point, I would always choose for the more narrow one.
Well, but the thing, you know, talking to engineers at these companies, there are plenty of people who are pretty excited about digging. I mean, this is sort of a really interesting, exciting, juicy engineering problem in a way. And there are people who are excited about tackling it. It's just not very high on the priority list.
Right.
You know, Facebook has bigger fish to fry and Google has bigger fish to fry right now. And so, you know, changing the fish frying priority list, you know, I think that's possible partly because I think there are people internally who would love to be set loose on it.
Isn't this a part of a sort of a broader societal, and maybe it's a function of the internet, but this concept of like that's been around for a while, the idea of more intense localization and you know, the McVillage, I guess, is what think they used to call it. This idea that you know, things are localized, and in this instance, it would be localized, I guess, psychographically. But at the same time, they're homogenized on a much, much sort of more transcendent level.
Yeah, and there's a fascinating sort of seam of research done by a professor at the University of Wisconsin who looks at the way that societies change when you start to have citizens growing up with a lot of choice. And, you know, the fact is that as societies become more affluent, they, you know, people can choose how to live more, and they choose generally to live with and around people like them. And so you've had this massive self-sorting effect just geographically, where we know, you know, that people live in communities that are much more homogenous now than they did 30 years ago. There's a great book called The Big Sort that tracks that. This is sort of the same phenomenon happening online, where, you know, in the one place where you would hope that you could go outside of your little McVillage, or in my case, my little Brooklyn neighborhood, where everyone, you know, is doing a lot of the same things that I am, you know, instead you're actually sort of carrying your little neighborhood around with you online wherever you go, and in fact it's very hard to get out of it. And I think that would be a shame if that's, I mean, it would be more than a shame, it would be a real problem if we're sort of unable to escape our own very narrow point of view.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that problem. I mean, what do you see the most problematic effects of this would be? I mean, obviously, if I'm looking for, you know, if I'm dealing with garden weeds, I want one that is, you know, zone 5 and this part of the country. But where else would the other problems come?
Well, you know, one of the basic problems is, you know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan famously said, we're all entitled to our own opinions, but not our own facts. And this makes it easier than ever to sort of feel like you have your own facts, and for those facts to diverge quite significantly. And I asked Google about this. I was talking to a PR person, and I said, well, if you have a, you know, if I'm a 9/11 conspiracy theorist and I Google 9/11, is it your job? You know, he was saying the thing that we need to show people is just whatever is most relevant for them. And I said, well, but if I'm the 9/11 conspiracy theorist, is it going to be most relevant to show me another conspiracy site, which I'm very likely to click on, or is it going to be most relevant actually to show me that Popular Mechanics article that debunked a lot of those conspiracy theories? And so, you know, and being a PR guy, he said, well, I don't know, we'll have to get back to you. but, you know, but I think that's sort of the challenge is, you know, not only are your own views being fed back to you in some cases, but you're not even aware that this is happening. So at least when you turn on MSNBC or you turn on Fox, you kind of you have a sense of what the editing rule is, what is going to be shown to you, what's not going to be shown to you, and you're making a choice to look at the world through that prism. With this, you don't know on what basis Google is editing things in or out. You don't know who it thinks you are. You don't know, therefore, what's being edited out. And it could be a lot. You wouldn't know. You'd never see it.
Fascinating. Well, let me ask you before I let you go. A broader question, more rooted in your experiences as the executive director of Move On, and what is your sense of what's happening in terms of online organization? I mean, I'm wondering if you see any significant changes that have taken place over the past couple of years, and where it might be going, particularly on the left, with what seems to be there still seems to be a time of where people are a little bit untethered, basically because with Obama as in office, it has sort of changed the dynamics a little bit from when Move On was the sort of the central focus in a position of almost of defense in some way.
Yeah. Well, I think taking off my Field the Rebel hat and putting on my Move On hat, I think there's been a period of realization that there has to be a progressive movement that's independent from, from the Democrats in Washington, from the structures of power, that can actually sort of push forward ideas, sometimes the leaders in Washington will take them up and sometimes they won't. But I think that's where things are going, especially on the economic front. There's a lot of exciting activity building this summer around, really putting down a very clear vision for how we should, move forward economically that takes care of the middle class, since, that's not something that we've seen from Washington very much. I think the challenge, which does get back to the book, is, being able to communicate broadly about that. And, when you're relying on something like Facebook, you do end up, Facebook is now as common a pass-along medium as email is, but you're increasingly just sort of, in this world populated by people who think like you. And so, you could have a really big campaign that gets a lot of people who are on the same page together, but you're not necessarily able to make your argument to people who think differently. And that's really one of the big challenges, I think, that we have right now in online organizing. We can get people together, but we can't necessarily make the argument to people who are on the other side.
It's much harder to expand the reach.
That's right. Yep.
All right. Well, Eli Pariser, the book is The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. Very interesting stuff. I really appreciate your joining us today on the program. We've got to take a break. Eli, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
We're going to take a break, folks. We'll be back in just a moment. I will take your calls at 646-257-3920. Oh, that may be difficult today. You got it? He says he got it. When we come back, the Republicans are now choking on Paul Ryan, and it's fascinating. We'll be right back on it. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. In 2 days, tomorrow in upstate New York, in the Buffalo area, we're talking about New York 26, I guess this is. It's a special election replacing that dude Chris Lee. He was the guy who was on Craigslist with his shirt off, posing in, a very the classic congressman half naked pose on Craigslist. Craigslist looking for some fun. He won his reelection with 74% of the vote. This is a very Republican district. John McCain carried it narrowly in 2008. This should not be a swing district. We've talked about this. And new polling came out over the weekend from Siena out of New York 26. The Democrats, Kathy Hochul, she gained 11. She's at 42% now. Jane Corwin at 38%, the Republican. She should be walking away with this. Jack Davis, the so-called Tea Party candidate, at 12%. He has dropped. Hochul actually picked up a decent amount of his support. Hochul has an 8-point lead with independents. She holds more Democrats, 76, than Corwin holds Republicans at 66. Hochul has a 55% favorable rating. This is a stunning development. And it is apparently very much a function of Jane Corwin's what appears to be only tepid support for Paul Ryan's Medicare plan. People who vote for Jane Corwin, here it is. 29%, let me see what this number is. 29% of people say that Medicare is their number one issue, and they're voting. Here it is. Medicare is the biggest issue in this Western New York district. More than one in five, about 20%, say it's the single most important issue, including 38% of Hochul voters. The single most important issue, more than one in five, it's about 29%, I guess. It is stunning. And apparently, I don't know if you saw that video of Jack Davis. This guy's a real nut job. He was a Republican, then he was a Democrat, now he's a Tea Party guy. He beat up somebody with a camera or smacked them around, but then it turned out that it was just the Republican's chief of staff that was sent over there. So it sort of backfired on them. You've got a poll out by the AP. Americans worry about the future of the retirement safety net. The poll found three out of five say the two programs are vital to their basic financial security as they age. They're referring to Social Security. Three out of five, Medicare and Social Security, vital to their basic financial security as they age. Scott Brown in Massachusetts has come out with an op-ed saying that he cannot support the House Republican plan to privatize Medicare, because he fears that health care costs will grow faster than the vouchers the plan provides. He's right. Here's the telling part. He writes this in Politico. It's basically his capitulation to the national media. He's afraid to say it in other venues because, of course, Rush Limbaugh is going to have a problem with him. This is becoming a huge theme. Politico had a big piece today. It might be a political time bomb. That's what the GOP pollsters warned as House Republicans prepared for the April 15th vote on Paul Ryan's proposed budget. Remember, nearly every single member of the House Republican caucus voted in support of this plan. If you ever had a theory that Obama could play 11-dimensional chess, I think this whole elevation of Paul Ryan early on in the budget debates and even when the Democrats controlled the House may very well be the best example. Now, just to say that he plays 11-dimensional chess, that may be the case. I just don't think that more often than not we're on the same page as to what the outcome should be. But Republicans are in complete disarray because of this Medicare proposal. They've gone all in. They've seen the polling numbers. 70 to 75%, depending on how you ask the question, say they don't want their Medicare cut. They don't want it destroyed. And that's exactly what the Republican budget proposal does. Politico continues, the poll numbers on the plan were so toxic, nearly as bad as those of President Barack Obama's health reform bill at the nadir of its unpopularity. It's back up. It's a little more popular now as people start to realize, like, hey, wait a second. Norsi can stay on his parents' plan. That helps Norsi. That helps Norsi's parents. That helps me as his employer. People are starting to realize. The staffers with the National Republican Congressional Committee warned leadership, you might not want to go there in a series of tense pre-vote meetings. But go there, the Republicans did en masse and with rhetorical gusto, transforming the political landscape for 2012, giving Democrats a new shot at life. This weekend, you had, well, you still have Newt Gingrich sort of, I can't even tell where he is on this plan right now. You've got Scott Brown running from this thing. I'm convinced that guys like Daniels are afraid to run because of this proposal. I think this is actually keeping people out of the race because they don't want to have to weigh in on this in any type of meaningful way.
Democrats should bring back that Republican motto from 2004, the whole flip-flop thing.
Oh, well, you're going to see that with Mitt Romney. You're going to see that with Mitt Romney. It's been more than a month since Speaker John Boehner and his lieutenant, Majority Leader Eric Cantor, boldly positioned their party as a beacon of fiscal responsibility, a move many have praised as principled, if risky. What is the principle here? What is the principle? They thought they could sell this to the American public as a way of providing more money for the insurance industry, as a way of upwardly distributing taxes that have already been collected to finance the cutting of taxes for wealthy people. I guess that's the principle, I suppose. I mean, if my daughter said, I really want to take a poop in the living room, and she did it, I don't think the idea that, like, wow, at least she's principled, at least she's sticking to her guns, would actually occur to me. In the process, however, they raced through political red lights to pass Ryan's controversial measure in a deceptively unified 235 to 193 vote with only four Republican dissenters. This is going to haunt them throughout the election. And sadly, while they will lose because of this, I think they probably will gain the Senate. They could lose the House. Sadly, what it does is it enables Democrats, particularly the neoliberals, and in the Democratic Party to essentially have their way, because again, the Republicans have moved so far to the right that the center has moved there. And I'm not talking about the center in terms of American citizens' perspective on what they want. I'm simply talking about the political center, where the ruling elites in this country have been able to keep the debate. Unions aren't having any of it, supposedly. Some of the nation's largest labor unions, according to the Washington Post, are cutting back dramatically on their financial support of the Democratic Party, saying they're highly frustrated with the failure of Democrats to put up stronger resistance to Republican proposals opposed by labor. The unions have cited what they see as Democrats' tepid response to Republican efforts to eliminate collective bargaining rights for public sector workers, cut Medicare funding, and require voters to show ID at the polls. Democratic response in this instances have been anemic. You can tell me all you want that Obama did not promise to be a liberal, but he did say he'd put on his walking shoes, didn't he? I don't know how much more specific you can get. If they try and attack unions, collective bargaining, I will put on my walking shoes and I will walk that line. I don't think he even mentioned it when all this stuff was going down in Wisconsin. I mean, you could tell me that I extrapolated from that, but I think it's quite clear. That is a fundamental promise that he broke. And I think at the time, he never expected that anybody would attempt to do this, frankly. Unions are simultaneously shifting their money and attention to focus on more political races at the state level. What you're seeing is unions are following the lead. I mentioned this story a couple of weeks ago. The International Association of Firefighters announced that they were going to stop all political giving on the federal level and focus on the local level, basically to whoever's protecting their interests. And now we're seeing it, and I think this is a good development. Robert Cruikshank had a very good post on Daily Kos. I'm going to try and have him on later this week to discuss it. It builds on the Cornel West comments and the tendency for liberals to assemble essentially, firing squad circles. And he's not talking about Cornel West attacking Obama. He's talking about liberals attacking Cornel West. And that dynamic, which is completely, it's an interesting piece, and we're gonna try and have him on to talk about it. A couple of quick other stories before we go to the post show at Majority FM. In the absence of federal laws requiring labels for genetically modified foods, we've talked about this in the past. Look, I don't think there should be a wholesale fear of genetically modified foods, but the idea that it can't be labeled seems ridiculous. I mean, we allow for the labeling of corn syrup and everything. Why wouldn't you? Because consumers don't want it. This is the ultimate free marketer. I mean, how can you have a free market if you don't give the individual the proper information to make a measured and considered choice? And apparently what's happening is that states across the country, four states, California, Oregon, Vermont, and Alaska, lawmakers are considering legislation that would pertain only to fish. Other states, including New York, are grappling with measures that would require all foods made from genetically modified ingredients to disclose that information on the label. Apparently now they're creating a special type of salmon that they are genetically modifying. They've taken Atlantic salmon and inserted a growth hormone from a Chinook salmon and a gene from an ocean pout. You can tell me all you want that this happens in nature. That doesn't. Species do not commingle in this way. The FDA says it cannot require a label once it's determined the altered food is not materially different from its conventional counterpart, which it has done in the case of salmon. I'll be eating Arctic char, thank you. Since the FDA approved the first genetically altered material for use in food in 92, the use of genetically engineered crops has skyrocketed. 93% of last year's soybean crop was genetically engineered. Byproducts of those crops, soy lectin, for example, are found in thousands of processed foods from chocolate bars to breakfast cereal. Genetically modified ingredients are present in about 80% of conventional processed food in the United States. You know, the issue is allowing the consumer to choose and make their own determination as to what they want. Come on in. Do you eat genetically modified food? Not that you know of. What if I was to tell you that 80% of all processed food in this country was contained genetically modified materials? Would that freak you out?
A little bit.
A little bit?
Yeah.
All right. Hang in there.
Thanks.
So the dude from FedEx freaked out about it. That's what he said. One last piece before we go. Mine owner's negligence. The first comprehensive report on the 2010 coal mine disaster in West Virginia, independent team investigators put the blame squarely on the owner of the mine, Massey Energy. You remember they just got cited another mine shut down a couple of weeks ago where investigators basically said this is unprecedentedly bad, what's going on there. Massey Energy concluding that it made life difficult for miners who tried to address safety and built a culture in which wrongdoing became acceptable. That's life for a non-unionized coal miner. We're going to take a break. When we head back, when we come back, we'll be in the post show. You can eye on me at Majority FM today on the post show. It's that time of year for me, folks. You know what that means. Eczema. Bad eczema. I could only sleep 3 or 4 hours last night. Stick around for the post show to get to hear me bitch about it. That should be fun. More Chris Rosen feedback. A couple more stories.
Call in, I can handle it.
Call in at 646-257-3920 or I am me at Majority FM. That number again, 646-257-3920. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about bees. The bee report came out today. I don't know what it said. We're going to find out tomorrow how the bees are doing. Very important, bees. Just about everything you eat, you'll find out more tomorrow. We'll be right back.